I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Hillary Clinton supporters were flabbergasted when the polls proved quote-unquote inaccurate for the 2016 election. The lingering disappointment caused some to lose faith in polling and its ability to forecast outcomes. Today, a renowned pollster tells us whether or not to believe the polling during this midterm election. We'll also ask him what he's seeing in some tight Missouri and Kansas races. Then, inspirational writer Anne Lamott is back with her blend of humor and insight. In her most recent book, she touches on despair and uncertainty, which can surround us all. Lamott offers ways to bring back hope. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. With another election bearing down on us, voters are subject to a daily barrage of endless poll results and interpretation. What do they do with that info, and who are they supposed to believe, especially when we're constantly told that President Trump's 2016 election is just the most glaring incident of the polls getting it wrong? To help us clear the muddled waters around political polling in the lead-up to the 2018 midterm election is Neil Newhouse. Neil is the co-founder of the Public Opinion Strategies in Alexandria, Virginia, where he joins us from today. He has twice been named Pollster of the Year by the American Association of Political Consultants, and to top it all off, he's a Kansas City native. Neil, always good to have you here. Welcome back.
Hey, Steve, appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
I'm going
to
ask the big...
That's a hell of an introduction, though. You know, the intro of, like, how we got it wrong in 2016.
Well, I'm going to give you a chance to get it straightened out here, Neil, because the big first question here, and of course I'm asking this to a pollster, should people trust political polls?
Well, hey, you know what the truth is no, all polls are not created equal. I mean, seriously, there are some good polls out there, and there are some bad polls out there, and there are some polls that are traditionally very good, and you know, and maybe get one wrong. Every poll has a margin of error, and when you listen to a pollster and listen to the whole entire explanation, it's always plus or minus X percent,
right.
3% in 95 out of 100 cases. Well, what about those other five cases?
Hmm.
You know what we all do. I mean, I got to tell you, our firm has done, I think, 1,700 polls this year. And, yeah, by you know, there's no stretch of the imagination to believe that we've got some of these that are well outside the margin of error. The problem is you don't know which ones they are.
I was going to say, what does a consumer do here, Neil? How can they sort it all out?
Pardon me?
How can a consumer sort it all out?
Well, first of all, I think there's over-reporting of polls. I don't think a consumer should worry about it. Consumers got to be looking at... I mean, consumer ought to be... The main consumers of the polls are usually the press, are, you know, truthfully the press. Voters ought to be looking at the candidates and what they're saying, and I mean, rather than who's ahead and who's behind. It's like watching the score of the Royals game in the fifth inning, you know, or seventh inning. That's not going to predict who's going to win or lose the game at the end. Hmm. Yeah, if we're talking about the Chiefs, now we know they're
different. So, it's a different story, different. Yes. Yeah,
different story completely.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's and if you're looking at national polls, like the national generic ballot to predict what's going to happen in the U.S. House, that's baloney. Hmm. That's, you know, you use that as kind of a, you know, to see how strong the wind is blowing, you know, for one party or another party, but it's not going to predict – you know, whether Democrats or Republicans, or Democrats win the House or Republicans
right.
hold it.
Yeah. Has polling changed since 2016, since we went through this the last time?
Well, yeah, I mean, let's go back to 2016. 2016, the national polls got it right, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was, you know, stunningly so. And yet, on the individual statewide level, the polls didn't pick up the movement in, you know, key states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, et cetera. Here's... The key to that is we have many more quality polls that are done on the national level, and statewide polling is not at – we don't have as many quality polls done on that level.
And why is that?
Has it? Well, It's because the major news organizations have generally not invested in statewide polling, generally invested in national polls. But here's the challenge. The question is, you know, have we changed things that we're going to get it better this time? It is much more difficult to predict turnout and who's going to vote in a midterm election than it is a presidential election. So even though we've, you know, the number of cell phone interviews have increased, the way our screening people, you know, has improved, but most people are going off registered voter lists, et cetera, and in their polling, trying to predict or trying to ascertain who's a voter and who's not a voter is incredibly difficult. And there's no guarantee that we're getting it any more correct in 2018 than we did in 2016. It is, but you understand that our firms, I mean, firms like ours, we work with candidates mostly, and so we're trying to help them go from point A to point B, in other words, gain votes in an election.
Right.
And we're less in the business of trying to predict who's going to win and rather trying to help a candidate design a message that appeals to voters. So it's that the whole turnout thing is extraordinarily difficult, and you're going to find a lot of firms with mud on their face after this election, I think.
And that will be because why? They just couldn't tell who was going to vote, Neil?
Yeah, I mean, Democrats have an edge in this election, no question about it. But their edge is based on voters who don't traditionally vote in midterm elections, millennials and minorities.
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to vote? I mean, we have seen an increase in, I mean, a 3 million person increase among Democrats in primary voting this election cycle compared to 4 years ago. So you'd think that that would continue on to the general election, but you just don't know it. And when you ask voters, how likely are you to vote? That is one of the most unreliable questions on a survey we could ask.
Hmm.
We've done testing on that, and then
because what people lie about that.
I'm not sure "lie" is the right word, but they don't get it right. I mean, we did a survey in Virginia before the governor's race a few years ago. Interviewed 1,000 voters and asked, you know, how likely are you to vote, and a couple of different variations of that. And then 4 months later, went back when the actual voter rolls were updated with who actually voted. We went back and compared our survey to whether voters actually voted or not. And we had like 25% of voters who said they're definitely going to vote didn't vote,
wow.
And 20% of voters who said they weren't going to vote did vote.
Huh, that's a big swing, a huge swing.
You know, yeah,
yeah,
unbelievable. So. We're trying to do models and trying to figure out who's likely to vote. It's a tough challenge.
So, you know, in 2016 with Trump and Clinton, one explanation you heard was that in a lot of cases, voters were making up their minds really late in the cycle. They just didn't decide until maybe a day or two before. And that's awfully tough for polls to pick up with any accuracy. Is that explanation hold any water to you?
It holds some. I mean, this was, I kind of refer to 2016 as a nose holder election. Voters were holding their nose and voting for one of the two candidates. It wasn't that they were necessarily in love with them, but they didn't like the other candidate. What I saw happening in 2016 was, a lot of voters who were unwilling to tell others they were voting for Donald Trump, just out of, I don't know, it's not out of embarrassment, but out of just fear of starting a debate they didn't want to get involved in.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw that when we did focus groups before the election. We do focus groups, and we go around the table and ask, and people would offer who they're voting for, and until one person said they're voting for Trump, other people were quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would speak up. And then after the election, we did a couple of post-election surveys, one in California, one in Michigan. And we asked an agree-disagree of Trump voters, were there times during this election where you were unwilling to tell others you were supporting Donald Trump? And 35% of voters said, yeah, they were. And they tended to be women from higher educated from the bluest counties in those states.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's really interesting.
So yeah.
So I think there's some of that as well. So it might have been late decision-making, but I think it was also some of these Trump voters were a little bit unwilling to tell a live phone or on the phone they're voting for Donald Trump.
Neil Newhouse is my guest. He's the co-founder of Public Opinion Strategies. He's a Kansas City native. If you have questions about the polls, this would be a great time to talk to one of the best in the business. 816-235-2888 is our number here, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. So do you expect a blue wave? Is that what's churning around out there, Neil, or can you tell yet?
Democrats are going to do well. It's going to be a good cycle for Democrats across the country.
It's supposed to be, but, though, right? It's the first midterm after a Republican president's been elected. Yeah.
But I think it's going to be more like I'd call it a split decision. I mean, here's the reason I say that. The House races, U.S. House races, and Republicans hold a significant margin in the House, but Democrats need to pick up 23 seats to win control. They're favored to do that right now, and they're favored to do that because there are like 23 seats right now that Republicans hold that Hillary Clinton won, and then there are a number of other seats that are vulnerable. So the playing field in the House races are on Republican turf, and so the Republicans are likely to lose a bunch of seats in the House, and so there will be that kind of groundswell. But in the Senate side, the Senate's being played on Democratic turf. You have a number of different races across the country, key U.S. Senate races, where Democrats are running in states that Donald Trump won and won handily.
Like Claire McCaskill here in Missouri.
Yeah, Claire McCaskill there, West Virginia, Joe Manchin. A number of states, Indiana. So you're looking at, I think, potentially a split decision where Democrats do well in the House and Republicans pick up seats in the Senate. And you got to go back to 1982 for a similar year like this, where this is the first midterm election of President Reagan. And I know you were just, you were in probably grade school back then.
Yeah, you're right. Yes, I was. Yeah, let's go with that. Yeah,
But you got to go back to then when Republicans lost 26 seats in the House and they picked up a seat in the Senate. So it's kind of like a split decision in terms of the country going both ways, providing a check to President Trump in the House, but yet giving him a greater margin in the U.S. Senate.
Let's go to some phone calls here, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. We're talking about polling with Neil Newhouse. Let's go to Rod from Independence. Rod, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve. I'm enjoying the discussion this morning. Now, in regards to the polling, in the last election cycle, there was something that happened late in the campaign, just before the election, that throws everything out the window regarding the polls. Now, and also earlier you asked if they lied about polls. If we don't take a look at the idea that may be that happening, we'll just unleash that on the population.
So what's your question for Neil, Rod?
My question is, how do we have polling that's going to be neutral?
How do we get neutral polling, Neil, which is, I guess, the objective here, right?
Yeah, that's the objective. But the caller is absolutely right in terms of what happened in 2016. That Comey letter hit late that really kind of did impact voters.
Right.
You never know. None of us can predict what's going to happen over the next 14 days. But how do you get polling that's number one is people – our job's much more difficult. Our job's more difficult because – now, the influx of cell phones, about half our phone calls, half the interviews are done by cell phone. Everybody has caller ID, and so we have a lot of people who just don't want to respond to polls. Mm-hmm. It takes us as many as 25,000 phone calls to complete a 400-sample survey.
Wow. Does that by itself skew the results?
Well, I mean, it doesn't by itself, because then we you know, you always take a look at the data and we make sure that it matches the district or the state or the nation in terms of education and age and ethnicity. And we try to make sure it matches. We'll sometimes weight data, you know, slightly to make sure it fits. But that's, I mean, Steve, when I started doing this, you know, a long time ago, it, you know, it took us, and we all we needed was, you know, 10 to 12 phone numbers for every one interview we wanted to complete.
Right.
Now it's thousands.
What would you say to someone who receives a call from a pollster? How would you advise them whether to take the time to respond or not?
Well, and that's it. Number one, I don't think people would actually know when they're getting a phone call from a pollster. People may say they're doing a poll, but it may be in the guise of trying to promote a candidate.
Right.
But if you're getting a phone call from ABC News, Washington Post, or from, you know, the NPR survey, or from NBC News, Wall Street Journal, they sometimes they actually identify themselves. If a poll asks you about demographics, asks you what your age, your education level is, et cetera, then it's an honest-to-goodness poll. If they start asking you message questions about, you know, disparaging one, you know, one candidate or another, you know, it's usually a candidate poll or a campaign message, and those are significantly different polls.
816-235-2888 is our number here. Let's go to Frank from Lawrence. Frank, you're on with Neil Newhouse. Good morning.
Morning, Neil. My question has to do with when you're taking a poll and publish the results, how does that affect people's voting? And as the screener said to me on the phone, do you actually do polls to see how that affects the people's voting rights?
So you're asking whether the outcome of a poll actually influences a voter's final decision as to how they vote.
Yeah. Correct. And, I mean, do you poll to see how that affects the results?
Right, gotcha.
I'll take the answer off the air.
You bet. Thank you. Go ahead, Neil.
Yeah, there have been studies on how polling impacts voters, and this is back in my poli sci days in college, where there's an underdog effect where people say, you know, screw that, I'm gonna vote for the guy who's behind because I believe in him, or there's the bandwagon effect. I don't think that people pay that much attention to polls, at least in the state or local level, and there are so many polls out there that show sometimes varying things. I don't think it has that much impact. And from our purposes, no, we don't poll to try to determine that. It's just not a priority for us. Let me give you an example of how nuts polling can be.
Right.
And it's just, and give me a Kansas example. Emerson College, the Emerson Polling Society of Emerson College does polling. They made a name for themselves in 2016 election, and they've done polling across the country. They did a poll in Kansas, too. So this is the open seat in Kansas.
Over in the Topeka area, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's they did a poll a month ago. They showed Watkins trailing Davis 31-35.
Mm-hmm.
So Davis has a four-point lead. Then on October 26th, they just released numbers just this week, they show Watkins leading Davis by 48-46.
Hmm.
So number one, they have Watkins down by four and then Watkins up by two, but they had undecideds at 30%.
Wow.
Before, and now they have undecideds at 6-7.
Hmm.
I mean, all polls just, they, you know, you can't tell me that Watkins has moved up 17 points in a month. That just doesn't happen in campaigns.
You're saying seeing 17, just based on the final numbers in October. I see where you're coming from. Right.
Yeah. He went from 31-48, and mm-hmm. Davis went from 35-46. In the current, the way politics is now working, Steve, and you've seen it in the last, you know, 20 years since you've been doing this stuff, is parties are much more polarized than they've ever been. And mm-hmm. voters, and almost every survey we do, we have at least 75% or 80% of Republicans voting for the Republican, and the same thing on the Democratic side. The two parties have chosen their sides. They're voting straight party. And so to have something like 30% of voters undecided is simply not realistic.
Let's go back to some calls here. Let's go to Ken from Lake Winnebago. Ken, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. The question is this. I've been called two or three times in my life in 60 years, and they seem to pre-screen me. They ask me one or two questions, like, do I like Hillary or do I like Vicky Hartzler? And if I don't answer correctly, they say, thank you, you're not qualified, and they hang up. Why do they do that?
Why do they do that, Neil?
Yeah. Because that's not a poll. Because, I mean, that's, you're not being, you're being polled for voter ID, for a get out the voter operation on behalf of a candidate or a campaign. You're not being polled in terms of whether people actually, you know, want to know what you think about the different issues, which is a shame because I wish more people were polled. But when you start off a we usually start our surveys off with, do you think things in the country or things in the state are headed in the right direction or off on the wrong track? And what do you, what's your approval rating of President Trump, and kind of go from there. When they screen you up top with, you know, do you have a fair or unfavorable impression of Hillary Clinton, and then either continue or not continue the interview based on that, you're not being polled for a real poll. You're being polled for a voter ID and get out the vote effort by a political campaign or political party.
You know, President Trump, Neil, is not even on the ballot this cycle, but it seems like he is the motivating factor for so many voters in this midterm. Do they approve or do they disapprove of President Trump? Is that an accurate way to see things?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, he may not be on the ballot, but he's not on the ballot, but he's in the minds of many, many voters who will be going to the polls, both in support of him and in opposition to him. And we see that in our data and our verbatim comments from voters. In fact, there's a polarization in the process that voters are taking to the polls with them in terms of the negativity that we're seeing in the political campaigns and advertising is also extended down to how voters feel about the candidates and about partisans on either side. And you see it in the data, but you also read it in the verbatim comments from voters. And I read one today. We just finished a poll in an unnamed state. And we asked, you know, how do you feel about this, this one candidate, et cetera. And let's see. You get a comment like, the man is an, well, I don't read that. there's a couple in here that it's like, here it is. I do not like Democrats. If one was dying of thirst, I would not cross the street to give him a drink.
Wow. Wow. Wow.
I'm like, holy God.
Holy buckets. Yeah.
Me?
Yeah.
So that, to me, I read something like that, and the rhetoric in when I'm reading that, which is really different from what I've read, you know, a month ago in terms of the same race, it's a little disturbing in terms of, yeah, we want voters to be intense and voters to be motivated, but it's stuff like that gives you pause when you read some of these surveys.
You know, you've done a lot of polling in Kansas over the years. I'm just wondering, because I have you on the phone here, do you have new numbers for Kansas, any of the races there, or on the Missouri side with McCaskill and Hawley?
I don't have I'm not polling in either of those races right now. I don't have numbers. The Kansas numbers are fascinating. I mean, the last few polls that I've seen out there have Kobach just narrowly ahead, but there's I wrote something I think 4 years ago, and Pat Roberts was running for re-election, and I think Brownback was running for re-election.
Yes.
As well, I wrote something in one of my polling memos that I thought my comment was, Kansas is on fire. It's burning, and there's a sense of kind of rebellion among voters, and just they were upset. And I think the same thing could be said today. You see really very competitive races in Kansas 2 and Kansas 3 and the governor's race. And all three of those races could just go either way right now, which is, I mean, what a difference from, you know, a few years ago when Kansas is, you know, assuredly a red state. And now it's really up for grabs.
Absolutely. Well, that's Neil Yeah, go ahead, Neil.
Well, on the Missouri side, the Josh Hawley, I've talked to the Josh Hawley guys, and they are, I mean, the media people, and they're pretty bullish. That's a race they think they've got an advantage in, and Trump wouldn't be going there over the next, I guess, in his last travel if they didn't think they had a real shot of winning that race.
I agree. Neil Newhouse of Public Opinion Strategies, based in Alexandria, Virginia. Neil, it's always a pleasure to have you here. Sure appreciate your time.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it, man.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with best-selling author Ann Lamott. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach discussed the tight race for governor and what he plans to do should he win the governor's office. Hear his plans at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, Kansas's Department for Children and Families was found negligent in a 2018 report, and workloads for Kansas City area caseworkers are triple what they used to be. We'll talk to the head of the department tomorrow on KCUR's Up-to-Date. Well, Ann Lamott is back, although she never really left us. She's out with another book, Almost Everything, Notes on Hope. It's Lamott's 18th book and 15th bestseller, and her 9th collection of mostly spiritual essays. In it, she talks about the ever after, the need to unplug now and then, which she's pretty sure she's learned in her 60-plus years of living, and at the same time, just how little she really knows. She's also thought many times about something else when she's driving down the highway, and that's yanking the wheel hard into an oncoming vehicle. Maybe a lot of us have had exactly the same thought. These are confusing times, and Ann Lamott is a welcome light in the fog for a whole lot of people out there. She joins us this morning from Marin County out in California. Ann, what a pleasure to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
This is a book subtitled Notes on Hope. And yet here you are on page 2, you're talking about this compulsion you've had for really most of your life to jump off tall buildings. You write this, to me, this is very natural. What's that all about, do you think?
It's just something I always noticed was that if I was in a skyscraper, of course, that used to be about 15 stories up, but I would, even as a little girl, I wrote about this in my second novel, Rosie, and the girl 7, I think. I would feel this sort of tug to the window, and I would consider jumping out, although I didn't ever and still don't have clinical depression. I have anxiety, but not depression. And I couldn't ever quite figure out until I had a great psychiatrist, and he said he thought it was exhausting for someone as sensitive as I am and as concerned about so many people and the whole world to be here. And at some point you know, gravity weighs us down. And the story I tell in Almost Everything is that I was the psychiatrist said, the solution will be to tell whoever you're with that you're thinking of jumping.
And I love this story, by the way. Yeah, I just love it.
Yeah, it'll break the trance and wreck it for you. And so I was in Cairo. A minister brought me there to do some sermons and some lectures. And we were way, 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 way high up near a cliff. And I said, I have to tell you, I promise to tell you that whenever I'm this high up, I think about jumping. And he just waved it away, said, oh, who doesn't?
And that sort of helped a little bit, didn't it?
And that helped a lot. Yeah, that really broke the trance for me.
Yeah. You know, life is hard. You say that in one way or another several times in this book, but I get the very clear impression that for Ann Lamott right now, life is also better. I mean, your son Sam is older, and maybe some of those tough years have passed, and maybe some of the really hard years for you have passed with the demons that you've wrestled with so publicly. And I was going to add here, you're in love, or at least it sounded that way in the New York Times the other day and in your book. Is life better for Ann Lamott?
Well, of course, life is, you know, so much easier. My son is 7 years sober, and he had a child at 19, which was not my idea, but he's been the greatest blessing. His name's Jackson. He lives here half the time. And he's a delight, and I'm in love, and I'm getting married in April. But
congratulations.
There's a chapter, Thank you. There's two chapters in this book that I think are really significant. One is that the chapter called Don't Let Them Get You to Hate Them, mm-hmm. which was based on something Booker T. Washington said originally, and then Martin Luther King picked up on, and my preacher preached on last year. And I realized what they always say in recovery is that if you've got a problem, go look in the mirror. And I realized that I was contributing to this extreme amount of hate and self-righteousness and right. And that the only person I was going to change, really, I mean, I always exhort people to vote and to help get one person who's a shut-in or lonely or whatever to get to help them get to the polls. But I realized that I didn't want to live this way anymore. You know, I got sick and tired of being so filled with hate and hopelessness. There's a guy I quote in the book that's at the end of his drinking, he said he was deteriorating faster than he could lower his standards. And it's such a, it's a great line. And I really got there with my own hate and judgment and feeling of doomedness. The original title of this book was Doomed, A Book of Hope.
And so the publisher didn't like that title, did he? Did she or he? Yeah.
Publisher did not think it was a big best-selling title. And so we changed it to almost everything. But then, so that chapter I thought was really, that no matter what's going on in my life here, that is lovely stuff going on in my life in this home that's very, very hard. And life is hard sometimes for everyone. And then the life of the country has never been more terrifying or divided and divisive and scary. And so I don't live inside, you know, a castle. I live in the real world. I'm in recovery. I have a little church school. I was born and raised in this county. I've lived here for 64 years. So I know everybody here, and a lot of them are older and are maybe sick and maybe critically ill. And a lot of them have teenagers that they are afraid they will lose to this dark past. And so it's real life all the way. The other chapter I think that might be a part of an answer to your question is the chapter on paradox, and that all truth is paradox. So that if something, say, like with the shootings in Pittsburgh, just seemed like a nightmare, seemed like just the gravest cataclysmic episode that we can remember, the truth is also that the young people in Pittsburgh organized rallies and they got everybody back to their feet with candles, creating light and warmth in the world. And they stuck together and they marched and they shared their water and they smiled and they cried together. And so that, and if everything seems like it's really wonderful and lovely, I'm getting married and my son and grandson are here and that's beautiful and all that, there's also the paradox that around me, a couple of friends are really, really sick. Mm. And there's a teenager that I don't know if she's going to make it back from the dark side. Mm. And so it's all a paradox. It's all mixed up. You know, I've said so many times, I think I said it in this book, that if I were God's West Coast representative, I would have organized things better. So more like a silverware drawer, and I'd have the scary, sad things over where the knives go. Then I'd have all the moments of grace and blessing and transformation where the big forks go. And then there would be kind of scary but exuberant things where the salad, you know, and it's not that way. It's like everything's been tipped out onto the counter. It's all mixed up, grace and catastrophe and blessing and hard times. So that is real life. I really wrote this book because I wanted to tell my 9-year-old grandson and my 15-year-old niece what I know that's true. And what's true is that everybody's pretty much the same inside, that if they're jealous of someone, all they have to do is get to know them and they'll find out that that person is jealous of them or that person has terrible self-esteem or has an eating disorder or is scared all the time. So that I wanted to tell my young ones that not to bother comparing their insides to other people's outsides, because it's a fool's game. The outside is what we spend all of our energy on, but the people that you want to live your life with and sit next to at dinner are the people who are doing the deep dive into the truth of who they really are and where they have found meaning in the world.
Best-selling author Anne Lamott is my guest. She's got a lot of fans in Kansas City. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our number here. Tweet us at KCUR up to date. Her latest book, her newest book, Almost Everything, Notes on Hope. You know, one thing you've learned, and I thought this was helpful, is that people can change. And as evidence for that, you tell the story of your Aunt Janet, who really wasn't your aunt, but she was in all practical purposes. One night, she asked the family to change for her. Tell us about that and what happened, because it was such an interesting story to me.
Oh, thank you. My cousins, we all grew up together. Our parents, on both sides, my father's sister and my mother's sister and all their kids lived here. And, my mother's side of the family is Jewish, and they had a aunt named Janet, and a grandma Marion. They were just so brilliant and hilarious and different than we were, you know, and exuberant. And we never really considered them anything but our blood relatives. And Janet got sick with a really pretty scary kind of breast cancer called inflammatory breast cancer. And she did all the chemo. One person out of four is alive, this used to be true, at the end of a year. And she did everything the doctor said, the surgery, the chemo, the radiation. And she also did the alternative healings of love and meditation and supplements and stuff. And one day at a holiday, she called us all together, probably 12 of cousins and five aunts and uncles. And she said, "I'm fighting for my life now, and I have loved every holiday we've ever had because you're so brilliant and hilarious, but everyone does this kind of attack humor, and I can't do that anymore because it hurts me energetically. And what I need you to decide is if you want to keep doing that, which is I would understand because it's so entertaining and elite, or you need to change what we talk about so that I can be with you, because I can really only do love and affection and stuff about real things like spirit and soul and our lives. And I want to hear about your lives, but you go ahead and decide." And we all decided we wanted Janet, of course. And
what an interesting way that she laid it out to you. What a loving way she laid it out to y'all.
Yeah. It's the hugest change my family ever went through.
And it's continued.
No.
Not, she's gone now, but it didn't continue. Yeah.
Well, it didn't continue at that level of being so conscious of what we talked about and the tone of voice, because we are everyone's overeducated and sarcastic and literary. But you know what happened is then my mom died, and then my aunt got really sick, and my uncle. And so life just kind of decided to soften us, like life in its distressing guys as a meat tenderizer. And we've been through, my cousins and I all went through each other's parents' decline, and that softened us and that gentled us like horses, you know. And so, and getting a little older softens your heart, and you don't need to be quite so, you know, our conversations were like ping pong, everybody kind of one-upping them, last person and whatnot. And now there's a lot more tenderness, but again, it's like the silverware drawer. there's more snark than there was when Janet lived 7 years after that conversation, and she line danced with her husband Ray a month before she died.
Yeah, right. It's in the
book. This stuff is real.
Anne Lamott's here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Let's go to Jerry from Liberty. Jerry, you're on with Anne. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Jerry.
Good morning. I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
Love the book, Help Thanks Wow. I wonder if you've ever thought about trying tandem skydiving or indoor skydiving.
Not so much. I'm kind of. What's indoor skydiving? That sounds like it's within the realm.
There are places. I first did it in Denver at a place called Sky Venture. There's one here in Kansas City. You put on a jumpsuit. They give you a little bit of training. And you go into an indoor wind tunnel, a vertical wind tunnel, and you float. You free float for about a minute.
Yeah.
It's a peak experience for me and my family. And maybe what you really are is an angel into.
Maybe that would help, man. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a long shot, let me say. But I'm kind of more of a sit on the couch and read type of girl. But anyway, I love your energy. Thank you.
You know, this notion, and you talk about this in the book, that we kind of think we know some things, but then you sort of realize at times that you really don't know anything, even after all the years of living. I'm wondering, what should we make of that? Because my own father, my 91-year-old dad, says that a lot. You know, experience is overrated. He says, I really don't know anything, even after all these years. I mean, that's kind of discouraging in a way. And you struggle with that in this book.
I think it's discouraging and it's really liberating at the same time. I mean, Socrates said the only thing he knows for sure is how little he knows.
Yes.
You know, and I think that without your dad or Socrates or whoever saying that, that we think we're just, we're missing the boat somehow because we're not focused or intelligent enough. But you know what? How could we know? I remember when my mom got sick, she had Alzheimer's. My brother, I have two brothers, and we were gathered around, and she also had diabetes. She was stealing food from Safeway, which was incredible blessing and grace because the clerks loved her, the checkers loved her, and they would pay for her bread and her cookies. And I still talk to them about it, and she's been dead for 15 years. But so I remember we finally, you know, in recovery, people always say, seek wise counsel. So we finally got together with an Alzheimer's nurse and we said, oh, we don't know how to do this and when we should do this and if she's okay or where of this. And we went on and on. It was just like everything we couldn't figure out. And she looked at us very gently and she said, well, how could you know? And it changed my life. And I thought it hadn't occurred to me that it wasn't just that we were clueless or not, or that we were too self-obsessed or whatever. And I've thought about that ever since. How could we know this stuff? People get sick in your family and maybe aren't going to survive. How could you know how to care for them? You need to probably call hospice or somebody is, you can't seem to help somebody stop drinking. Well, no one in the history of life has ever gotten anyone else sober. How could you know that? It seems like you should be able to get them to see the light and live the way that you're positive would be a really healthy way for them to live. You need to talk to someone who's been there. The only thing that's going to save a person with alcohol or drugs or eating disorder is the catastrophe of hitting a bottom, and people who've had what they've had who come and say, can I sit down with you? You know, I got you a cup of coffee. I hope you like cream and sugar. And then that's the only thing that's ever saved anybody. So I find it liberating and troubling that that ultimately we probably don't know nearly as much. And, you know, the great theologian Paul Tillich, remember him?
Right, sure.
From the 60s. He had that beautiful line that the opposite of doubt isn't, the opposite of faith isn't doubt, it's certainty. You know, so I see somebody who's doing certain, getting That's their certainty all over me, and I'm not really going to sit next to them again.
Anne Lamott's here. Sue from Lawrence, you're on with her. Good morning.
Morning, Steve. Morning, Anne. On your upcoming wedding.
Thank you.
When you were in Kansas City last at Unity Temple, I believe he was with you. And I have actually read all of your books, and I'm really looking forward to this one. Comment I have is that a friend of mine gave me a copy of Traveling Mercies the day before my mom died, which apparently was the same year as yours. And it kept me from going completely crazy. So
I'm glad.
Yeah. I've given away at least 36 copies since then.
Wow.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's worth it. My question for you is, are you going to do a book tour on this one?
Got home yesterday or something from 2 weeks on the road, 12 cities in 12 days. And so I'm in this kind of stunned state of really feeling my age, and my feet are killing me, and I'm sick of myself. But, you know, I'm ecstatic to be home, and I'm mostly on the couch reading with my dog these days, and Neil and my son or grandson wander in and out. And I never pick the cities I go to. I love Kansas City. This is Kansas City, Missouri, right?
Right.
Yeah, I've been there a number of times. My prayer partner from church, who's 20 years younger than I am, went to medical school there. And so I always arranged for book tours or lectures to be in Kansas City so I could be with her and we could have a slumber party in my room. And probably my favorite novel of all is Mrs. Bridge, which I think takes place in Kansas
City,
right?
Absolutely.
And it's the greatest novel for writers and novelists of all time, because first of all, it's so beautiful, but it's also these short chapters that you could conceivably write yourself. But so anyway, I won't be in Kansas City this year and I won't be anywhere near there. I've got three events on the West Coast in about a week or so. And but maybe next time.
Yeah.
And Mazel Tov to you, and God bless you. Good.
And your words today have just hit me just where I needed to be hit. So thank you so much, and thank you for speaking with me.
Yeah, thanks, Sue. Okay. I appreciate
You're
it.
You're welcome.
You know, Anne, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say my son, who's 29, who accidentally had this baby at 19, who I live for and who I adore, but he has a website called Howdy Human. Mm-hmm. And it's like the most human truth tellers. It's Jack Kornfield and Gloria Allred and Brené Brown and all these these people that are just talking, Julia Cameron one of the profoundest writing books ever written, and they're telling you how to be human. And Sam does these podcasts, and he has written on his tattooed on his wrist, "We never give up," and that's how he's raising his son. And it's so tempting to give up on all your idealism and your faith these days, because even by the time I get off talking to you, something new and bad might have happened. That's what it's been like for the last month. But you know what? I think of my son's wrist, "We never give up." And I think about all those people at Howdy Human saying, "We never stop being human. We never stop hoping. We never stop believing in life and goodness and the decency of almost everyone." And we become a part of that. We take care of the poor. Every wisdom tradition says the most important thing to do, to be close, to find union with a higher power, to find union with your own best angels, take care of the poor, get thirsty people water, visit people who can't get out, sit with them, bring them a few flowers from your garden. And even if they're cranky and they were mean last time, because you, by showing up, are bringing them hope, and then hope exists, right?
Right. That's Anne Lamott, her new book, Almost Everything, Notes on Hope. And it's always great to have you with us. Thanks again.
Oh, thank you, having
all the
Thanks
best to you. You bet.
Bye-bye.
Jazz is still very much alive in Kansas City. You're listening to it right now, but staying relevant in the music industry is never easy. Tomorrow, Kansas City trumpet legend Stan Kessler joins us to tell us how he's managed to do it. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.